out, that I put these bunch of the questions, you read the 16th chapter of Numbers, and you have got perhaps answers to the questions. But there's going to be a small fraction of you that haven't done that. That is, that all of this is new to you, that you have wanted to read the 16th chapter of Numbers, but your schedule has been so demanding that you haven't gotten to it yet. So although I was not going to have the chapter read, because it was going to take too much time, I'm going to have the chapter read. But I'm not going to go around the room, because that would take the rest of the hour if we did that. And then different people have different translations, and the next person said, where are we? It doesn't agree with what I'm looking at. So I asked Charlene to read the 16th chapter to us, which gives us the whole overview of what happened. Now, there were very few things that happened in this 40-year wilderness period that we know about. You know a lot about what happened at the beginning when they left Egypt, and you know about Sinai and the golden calf. Lots of things that you know a lot about what happened at the end when we've got Balaam who comes, and we've got Moses dying and Joshua taking over and going in. But if I ask you what happened in between, I think that a lot of you would be hard pressed to come up with anything. And Korah is one of this is one of those experiences that happened there in the wilderness. I find it instructive, almost never talked about. And so that's what we're going to talk about today. So I've asked Charlene, read it as fast as you can. So if you don't happen to like her doing that, it's my fault. So Charlene, let's hear what we have in the 16th chapter of Numbers.
Now Korah, the sons of Izhar, the son of Kohath, the son of Levi, with Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, and On, the son of Pelet, sons of Reuben, took action. And they rose up before Moses, together with some of the sons of Israel, 250 leaders of the congregation, chosen in the assembly, men of renown. They assembled together against Moses and Aaron and said to them, you have gone far enough. For all the congregation are holy, every one of them. And the Lord is in their midst. So why do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the Lord? When Moses heard this, he fell on his face. And he spoke to Korah and all the company, saying, tomorrow morning the Lord will show who is his and who is holy, and who will bring him near to himself, even one whom he will choose, and he will bring near to himself. Do this. Take census for yourselves, Korah and all your company, and put fire in them, and lay incense upon them in the presence of the Lord tomorrow. And the man whom the Lord chooses shall be the one who is holy. You have gone far enough, you sons of Levi. Then Moses said to Korah, hear now, you sons of Levi, is it not enough for you that the God of Israel has separated you from the rest of the congregation of Israel to bring you near to himself, to do the service of the tabernacle of the Lord, and to stand before the congregation and minister to them? And that he has brought you near, Korah, and all your brothers, sons of Levi, with you. And are you seeking for the priesthood also? Therefore, you and all your company are gathered together against the Lord. But as for Aaron, who is he that you grumble against him? Then Moses sent a summons to Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, but they said, we will not come up. Is it not enough that you have brought us up out of the land flowing with milk and honey to have us die in the wilderness, but you would also lord it over us? Indeed, you have not brought us into a land flowing with milk and honey, nor have you given us an inheritance of fields and vineyards. Would you put out the eyes of these men? We will not come up. Then Moses became very angry and said to the Lord, do not regard their offering. I have not taken a single donkey from them, nor have I done harm to any of them. Moses said to Korah, you and all your company, be present before the Lord tomorrow, both you and they, along with Aaron. Each of you take a fire pan and put incense on it, and each of you bring his censer before the Lord, 250 fire pans. Also, you and Aaron shall each bring his fire pan. So they each took his own censer and put fire on it, and laid incense on it, and they stood at the doorway of the tent of meeting with Moses and Aaron. Thus Korah assembled all the congregation against them at the doorway of the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord appeared to all the congregation. Then the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, separate yourselves from among this congregation, that I may consume them instantly. But they fell on their faces and said, O God, God of the spirits of all flesh, when one man sins, will you be angry with the entire congregation? And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the congregation, saying, get back from around the dwellings of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. And Moses arose and went Dathan and Abiram, with the elders of Israel following him. And he spoke to the congregation, saying, depart now from the tents of these wicked men and touch nothing that belongs to them, or you will be swept away in all their sins. So they got back from around the dwellings of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. And Dathan and Abiram came out and stood at the doorway of their tents, along with their wives and their sons and their little ones. Moses said, by this you shall know that the Lord has sent me to do all these deeds, for this is not my doing. If these men die the death of all men, or if they suffer the fate of all men, then the Lord has not sent me. But if the Lord brings about an entirely new thing, and the ground opens its mouth and swallows them up with all that is theirs, and they descend alive in Sheol, then you will understand that these men have spurned the Lord. As he finished speaking all these words, the ground that was under them split open, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up and their households, and all the men who belonged to Korah with their possessions. So they and all that belonged to them went down alive to Sheol, and the earth closed over them, and they perished in the midst of the ascendants. All Israel who were around them fled at their outcry, for they said, the earth may swallow us up. Fire also came forth from the Lord and consumed the 260 men who were offering the incense. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, say to Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, that he shall take up the censers out of the midst of the blaze, for they are holy. And you scatter the burning coals abroad. But for the censers of these men who have sinned at the cost of their lives, let them be made into hammered sheets for a frame of the altar, since they did present them before the Lord, and they are holy. And they shall be for a sign to the sons of Israel. So Eleazar the priest took the bronze censers, which the men who were burned had offered, and they handed them out as a plating for the altar, as a reminder to the sons of Israel, that no man who was not of the descendants of Aaron should come near to burn incense before the Lord, so that he will not become like Korah and his company, just as the Lord had spoken to him through Moses. But on the next day, all the congregation of the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron, saying, you are the one who have caused the death of the Lord's people. It came about, however, when the congregation had assembled against Moses and Aaron, that they turned toward the tent of meeting, and behold, the cloud covered it, and the glory of the Lord appeared. Then Moses and Aaron came to the front of the tent of meeting, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, get away from among this congregation, that I may consume them instantly. Then they fell on their faces. Moses said to Aaron, take your censer and put in it fire from the altar, and lay incense on it. Then bring it quickly to the congregation and make atonement for them. For wrath has gone forth from the Lord. The plague has begun. And Moses took it as Moses had spoken, and ran into the midst of the assembly, for behold, the plague had begun among the people. So he put on the incense and made atonement for the people. He took his stand between the dead and the living, so that the plague was checked. But those who died by the plague were 14,700, beside those who died on the account of Korah. Then Aaron returned to Moses at the doorway of the tent of meeting, so the plague had been checked.
Wonderful. That's the background. That's what we're going to talk about. And the first question, which is not that easy to divine from the reading, is what's the relationship here? You have a lot of being said about Aaron, and of course you have a lot being said about Korah. What is the relationship between these two? Tom.
Yes. So later on in Cousins, we find that in number 16 through 21. So Korah was a Levite. He was descendant of Kohath, and was born of a Levi. So the Kohathite sons were Amram, the sons of Amram, heir of Aaron, and then the son of Ithamar was the father of Korah, and they were brothers. So that makes them cousins. So anyway, they were both descendants of Korah and descendants of the Levites.
That's all true. And if you haven't studied it on in advance, I'm not sure I'd want to quiz you later, because there's a whole lot of names that aren't names we use today. Uncle were Smith, Brown, and Johnson. I guess maybe it might be a little bit easier for us to get our mind around it. Judy had her hand.
I think on this graph, it said that was number 6, and it should be Exodus 6.
Exodus 6?
Exodus 6, 16 to 20.
Yeah, anything that any of you say, I accept it. So, but get the picture. You know, you can see all of us, you sons of Levi. Have you seen that phrase a lot in when Charlie read to it? So we're going to start up at the top with Levi. Now, Levi had three sons, and we kind of like know about those because there were certain duties that went to that family. And so, and the way they camped, you know, there was a around the tabernacle, there was north, south, east, and west, but we only had three sons. So you've got a small problem as to what's going to happen, but you have Gershom, Kohath, and Merari. Those were the three sons. Those became three kind of like family units, and that takes care of three of the compass points that run. But the key one was the one on the east, and that was, as it were, Moses and his house, Aaron, priests, and so on. But that's not a separate family, but it's like separate status that is associated with it. And so Moses and Aaron are from which of these three sons of Levi? You have a choice of Gershom, Merari, or Kohath. You'll take Kohath. That's a good choice. Okay, so Kohath has his own sons. He happens to have four of them that are named, but there's only two of them that really matter to us. And the two that are named, the two brothers, Amram, we probably remember that one because he's the father of Moses and Aaron. He's also the father of somebody else. Miriam. And Miriam has one of her own experiences tucked away in the book of Numbers that becomes instructive if we were to look at it. So we have Amram out there, and Amram has a brother, Izhar. Not exactly a name that comes trippingly off the tongue, but that's his brother. And he has, of course, sons, one of which is Kohath. So these two brothers, Amram and Izhar, each have sons, so they're cousins. And it's like if we were reading the scriptures and they would have this family tree kind of there for us, they would have. So other people generally write the family trees and then they publish books and then we can see it and then it becomes clear. But when you read it through, it's not so clear. Now, it's kind of instructive to ask that question first, because the second question is, what do you think, why do you think Korah decided to do what he did? I see.
He was jealous that his cousin was getting all these inheritance. He wanted to be the leader.
I think that's right. I think that's right. It doesn't come out and say that, however. But he is a Levite. He has been separated off from the people. There is a status that is associated with the Levite. But among the Levites, there is other levels of status, and that's not him. Whatever it is that he's got, Aaron has more. In fact, Aaron is more than any other Levite, really. I'm going to say with the exception of Moses here, because Moses is clearly the leader of the people. But as far as Aaron is concerned, he is the high priest. And the high priest is the one that does the important things. He's got the robes, he's got everything. And that's not Kohath. Okay.
And my translation is a little different than hers on what Kohath has to say. He says,
You have gone too far?
Too far.
Okay, and who is he saying this to?
To Moses.
He is saying this to Moses, you've gone too far?
You've gone too far.
Okay. Right. And why has he gone too far? From the scripture. Any, okay, Joanna has a thought. Go. It's always just amazing to me that when there's power and prestige that people want that. I'm looking at the summit in it, and I say, who would ever want to be president of the United States? Who would ever want this? And the answer is a lot of people would really like to have that job. And yet, when you look at it, it's like all of these things, you need to only look at the prestige, but the responsibility, the duties, that all of those things are just, it's horrible to think about it. And so, and I would have just said that I would have said that Moses, I don't think that Moses appointed Aaron. Thank God he's the one that appointed. And it's like the people have lost their perspective about what is going on, as though Moses is the one that, of course, he would naturally appoint Aaron. It's his brother. So what did you expect from the children of Amram? I mean, this is, of course, what would happen. You can see how this would be played out. I have Joanna, and then I think I have Charlene. But we all have no microphones, so do it loud, Joanna.
Okay. It's just that Korah said that the whole congregation is holy.
Yeah.
And so the Lord chose the whole congregation.
Yeah,
so.
Right. That to me is what's very interesting. He has no ambition whatsoever. All that he's doing is speaking to the congregation. The congregation is what is holy. And here you have set yourself up among this holy congregation. You've gone too far. Can you imagine the reaction of Moses and all of this? Moses didn't even want to be there in the first place. Once he had gotten used to tending sheep in Midian, it suited him just fine. And he remembers what things used to be. And so when he had the opportunity to have a leadership position, he said, I can't really speak. I'm tongue-tied. I used to be able to speak the language of the court, but I can't anymore. I'm sure you can't pick somebody else. I mean, there's somebody that's really ambitious in order to grab power. Okay, Charlene, and then we'll come over here.
Also in time setting, this is not long after the spies had returned. And Joshua and Caleb said, yes, we can take them. And the rest of the spies said, no, we can't. And that the entire thing played out where they wanted to go anyway, and they were slaughtered. Mm-hmm. And that by this point, Korah's going, rebellion is right. I know I can get the people to side with me, and we will find a better place than wandering around for what Moses has said. We have to remain here for 40 years and have our corpses die in the wilderness.
Right.
No, we're going to do it differently.
Right. There's always somebody that has a better plan. It's just amazing. You see this being played out in the scriptures all the time. No matter what the problem is, somebody has a plan. And then the next day, somebody has a better plan. And after a while, you wonder how anything ever gets done. Okay.
Mine is simple. It said that Moses fell on his face, and you think of him falling on the ground with his face down.
Mm-hmm.
But it suggested in this translation that it was actually the expression on his face. So I can only imagine when this was presented to him, the expression on Moses' face.
Right. That's why I'm home, not again. All the things that I have to struggle with, I've got this, a Levite, no less, my cousin. And the thing that I thought kind of supported the idea of this jealousy is that at the beginning, it sounds like this is a challenge to Moses. And yet, when you come down to verse 3, they gathered themselves together against Moses and against Aaron. That's the phrase that the sunlight, and Aaron comes through as somebody who's just trying to do his job most of the time. And so it's like he's kind of like the innocent participant in this. And yet, there he is mentioned in that verse. And that's where I think that Korah doesn't want to replace Moses. Korah wants to replace Aaron. It's the high priest.
Plural you in that.
Yes. Well, probably got it both. He would unite church and state if it were left to him. I mean, the high priest would not only be the one in charge of the religious world, and he would take care of everything. I mean, he sees himself as a natural leader, and everything comes through to impact. Yes. Okay. Does it work again? Okay.
Hello.
Well, speak about it.
Okay. First of all, Korah and that tribe had the privilege or the responsibility for the vessels, and they were serving in there, but they seemed to want more. And I think Psalms 106, 16 to 18, this is chapter deals with the rebellious of Israel. And verse 16, when they became envious of Moses in the camp and of Aaron, the Holy One of the Lord, the earth opened up and swallowed up Dathan and engulfed the company of Abiram. So we have scriptural evidence that they were envious and they wanted more than serving the vessels and being servants in the ark.
And they already had so much more than everybody else. Just wanted to emphasize in verse 10, Moses speaks to Korah, and he says to Korah, seek ye the priesthood also, which is another way, I think, the way Scripture, in this convoluted way that is expressed in translation, is essentially saying, I know you're seeking the priesthood. So when he says, seek ye the priesthood also, Moses essentially is seeing what is seeing right through this. So you would think that any, no matter how charismatic a leader Korah might be, you would think that his work was going to be cut out for him to make a kind of a frontal attack at essentially taking the priesthood from Aaron. Forget about God, which they always seem to do in these equations. So the third question is, what did he do to ensure success? It's like you don't go, you have to count the cost, as it were. Okay, Steve.
He rounded up.
Wait, we've got a...
Yeah, Mike?
Yep.
He went around and converted all the other leaders and said, this guy Moses, he's not doing us any good. You can come with me and we'll fix things.
Okay. And another hand.
Oh, since he brought a lot of the other Levites close to him, so that means he gathered them up, he corralled them, he talked to them, he brought them in the middle of the group.
There was one particular tribe that is singled out. Joanna?
Reuben.
Tell us. Can you please elaborate about why it might be Reuben?
So Reuben was the firstborn.
Yes, he was. And what advantage did he have because he was the firstborn?
He inherited.
Yeah, but did he get anything? He didn't. And the answer, the question is, what advantage did Reuben get? And the answer is, he didn't get any. What advantage should he have gotten? Well, in Reuben's mind, you can well imagine that he ought to have a double portion, or he ought to have. He ought to have some status as the firstborn, because he was the firstborn. Forget about the fact that maybe he wasn't a model firstborn, but nonetheless, he was the firstborn. Now, I like to think, reading between the lines, that there is a kind of a unease that goes on among the Reubenites, and that Korah, being able to read personalities and character, knows this. Now, Reuben is a tribe, and it is in fact the firstborn, and I can just easily see Korah going to the tribe of Reuben saying, don't have what you really deserve. And you never are going to have it. You know that as well as I. Because of Moses and Aaron. And because of them, you do not have the status in this nation that you should have. But it wouldn't be that way if I was a high priest. Now, I know this sounds kind of tough to do, but if we work together, we can make that happen, and your state is going to be a lot better under me than it is ever going to be under him. That is supposition. But that's the way I read what is happening here. That it wasn't just the Reubenites, but I get the impression that they were the keystone in Korah's plan to make this rebellion successful. And as we read the account, he didn't just stop with them. I think that he went quietly around to all the other leadership and played on their dissatisfaction. And no matter how good you have it, folks, something is going to dissatisfy you. And if that's the case, somebody can use that. It's like push your button, as it were. Stop, and then.
In support of what you said, in verse 41, after we heard those says, so Korah not only got his entourage of 250, and he said, Reuben said, the next day, in verse 41, the whole Israelite community grumbled against Moses and Aaron. So Korah did a good job of politics.
That it happens to be a verse I put in bold in my copy, because to me that nails it. It wasn't a lot of spectators looking on with no particular vested interest one way or the other. It doesn't make any exceptions. It says all the congregation of the children of Israel. So it's like they were all expecting some kind of windfall from this rebellion, and now that they're not getting it, they don't like this at all. And so they call these the people of the Lord. You have killed the people of the Lord. And the thing that to me this is just so funny is to see this kind of argument being made, because here's Moses and the whole congregation saying to Moses, you have killed the people of the Lord. And you almost see Moses saying, and how exactly did I do that? Well, you opened up the earth, and the earth swallowed them up. But what happens with mob mentality is the thinking just all stops. From our vantage point, not involved with it, we can look at it, but there's a lot of times that when the mob takes over, there's no thinking.
When Charlene gave the timeline by reminding us that the 12 spies had shortly returned, I went to try to find out when did Miriam rebel, and it surprised me that she rebelled before the spies went out, so that the whole congregation had already had the experience of the punishment that came to Miriam when she questioned God's choice, and they didn't remember that when they were
They have such short memories. Constantly, this is being shown over and over. I can understand that when you've got a generation that passed. When you've got a generation that has had some experiences, it's like, I'll never forget the horror of that moment. And that generation dies. I can understand that the next generation says his father talked about that, but when it's the same generation, I find that awfully hard to understand. Tom, did you have your hand? Oh, well, just take Bill, because Rick is close.
I got some thoughts. If you point out something to me, Michael. You know, it's amazing. It's sort of like it's like the world is, basically. These people aren't interested in what God wants. They're interested in what they want. Right. Korah actually must have been a very popular person.
Oh, yes.
And he basically, convinced the congregation that they were being left out, they weren't being treated fairly.
Mm-hmm.
And after all, look what I would do for you.
Right.
Right. And it's kind of like the world thinks, you know, it's self-centeredness is what did it for me.
Right.
No reliance on God, and that's what it's all about.
And yet,
there's no message for us.
And the funny thing about all of this is that every morning they go out and gather manna. Just where do you think that's coming from? And the funny thing too with the spies that always went through my mind is that when they wanted to stone Joshua and Caleb and elect a leader to take them back to Egypt, what always goes through my mind is that, and just who do you think is going to open the Red Sea for you? Who and you expect God to give you manna all during this trek from where you are back? But again, with the mob mentality, there's no thinking stops. Huh?
I wanted to make one point on Korah and his privileged condition of all the Levites. Yet he was so blameworthy and arrogant in this instance because he went to the camp. They were consecrated, as we recall. The Levites were consecrated in the event of the Korah calf and so on. But here he's going to unconsecrated in the camp to get support for his rebellion.
Well, this is called politics. And when you are dealing with politics, people often believe that the ends justify the means. And this is a worthy end, and so whatever it takes, one of the things, is going to occur. Now, you know what happens. They make this challenge with turning with bread, but Jehovah comes to us. The earth opens up and swallows up the rebels. Doesn't seem to swallow up their fire pans, I think, with the censers, is the way the King James renders it. They have had incense being offered in these fire pans, and so the And it may very well be that there were kind of like two different executions that are going in here. There's the execution of the earth opening up, swallowing the tents, the stuff, the wives, the little ones that belong to these ringleaders. And then there's the 250 that have the fire pans, and it says, does it say fire came up from
Yeah, so I think
maybe we have two different executions that are going on here. And there's always been this question, kind of like, because it's never explained, what does it mean, the glory of the Lord appears? And what is it exactly that happened? And I always have at least a mental picture, could be possibly, that we have this cloud that was always over the tabernacle, and there's this thought that that cloud could very well have been sort of dissipated into a rather big cloud that acted as a shield of the sun, because the sun would be terrible in the wilderness. And so the cloud actually was a protection from the sun, but you would have that vertical part of the sun, and that lightning out of that cloud, which would be a very unusual thing, could be the glory of the Lord. It could also be the means of execution. That lightning from the cloud striking these people with the copper censers, killing them. I mean, lightning kills. And so that it is clear that this was an unnatural death. This was the Lord that was executing them. But in any event, the censers are left behind. They are there. They're not swallowed up. Then that has a thought.
Well, the way I'm reading this is the glory of the Lord appears the next day when all the congregation comes and criticizes Moses. But the men with the censers, that happened right after the earth opened up in verse 35. And fire came out from the Lord and consumed the 260 men who were offering incense. And then Moses instructed them to retrieve the censers.
Well, I thought that verse 35 just followed 34, that it was all happening at the same time. Did you mean
that? But I was questioning your saying of the glory of the Lord appearing and covering the tent. That's the next day.
Okay. Okay, my memory has been that it had happened when the earth opened up, and there's no glory of the Lord. The earth just opens up.
That's in verse 42.
42? Right. And this is where it becomes really ominous. Because now we're not talking just about 250 or anything else. It's not the whole congregation. But let's just stick with the census for a minute. We'll move on as we're moving down through this chapter. One of the questions that almost is kind of like a trivia question that hardly anybody ever gets the answer is, what article of furniture for the tabernacle that was constructed by the artisan before the tabernacle went into service was different at the end of the sojourn in the wilderness than when it started? And you know it because we just read it here. But I bet if we didn't read it here, you'd be hard. But what do you mean? It's like the candlestick, the incense altar, the brazen altar, but this is different. Those poor Levites that had to carry the brazen altar, can't you just see the sink? Oh no. It was heavy enough before, and now they take 250 censers, let's hope they're small, and they hammer those censers and into plates. And they take those plates and they put those plates on the side of the altar that is in the court. Why did the Lord direct Moses and Aaron to do that? Oh, it says, okay, I'm not asking any other. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, they shall be for a sign.
Okay. Else?
It was the job of Korah's group to carry the brazen altar, among other things. And so they had that heavier burden from there on in.
I never thought of that.
That was not my original thought.
How appropriate that they do that. Oh, I love it. I mean, it's so appropriate. There is justice.
And it goes on to say that that they should remember that no one except the descendant of Aaron should come to burn incense before the Lord.
Right. And, you can ask the question, okay, we have the Passover and the children of Israel leave, but why is it necessary that you have to repeat this every year? And of course you know, because this is the time that we talk about all that, and that is because you're to tell your children are going to say, why are we doing it? And you're going to say, let me tell you why we're going to do this. And you explain, and you go through it, and then they teach their children, and their children's children, because otherwise people forget. It is just so easy to forget. And this is the way of making sure that they don't forget. This is going to be an ordinance. You're going to do it every year. You're going to do it at this time. You're going to do it and so on. And it becomes important to them, doesn't it?
Sorry, I'm bringing things up, but if Korah's family was responsible for carrying the brazen altar, there are no family members.
The tribe is responsible. Korah is a member of the tribe of Kohath. The entire tribe of Kohath did not disappear. And so that is what is happening. So there's the sort of the poetic justice of all this. Huh?
In Numbers 26, I think that's the verses that anyway, so are Korah's sons. We're not killed.
Numbers 26, the sons were not killed?
No. Verse 11, yeah, okay.
I didn't know that.
It describes Yeah, the sons of Korah have not died out. The earth opened up and so on, so on, along with Korah, when the company died, with the 250 men were devoured, and that became a warning. So the sons of Korah did not die, nor does it say anywhere in Scripture that I could find that his family died, or that they were swallowed up. It doesn't say anything about his wife. So evidently, they didn't all of his family didn't follow in his rebellion.
Evidently. I didn't know that either. That was a nuance that I was missed by David.
Okay, I have a question.
I can't argue that.
One observation here. It talks about the sons of Israel. They're talking about the whole congregation of Israel, all of the nation. But that's in verse 38. Then down there in verse 40 that we talked about, we're talking about, again, the sons of Israel, again meaning, I believe, all of Israel. And, of course, they were all sons of Israel. We go back to the Exodus account when the Lord said to Moses, tell Pharaoh that, you know, let my son go, my only son, the sons of Israel. And so I think they were all sons of Israel. And certainly, Kohath could not have been the descendant of Aaron, so he couldn't have been one of these. And he was a layman. He did not have certain responsibilities, I think an adjunct. He was subservient to the priesthood. And so he had to serve them. And there was jealousy there, I'm quite sure. But nonetheless, then it says that do not burn incense before the Lord, so that he will not become like Korah and his company. This is the Lord has spoken to them through Moses. But the point is, here is the remembrance of this event. And I believe that it means more than just the sons of Israel. By that I mean they were all sons of Israel. But I believe it means here that it was a lesson and a remembrance, I would say, particularly to the Levites. They were in Numbers 151. They were supposed to protect the congregation. They were camped near the tabernacle. And so they were supposed to be a protection for them, as was the priesthood. So at any rate, I think this was a remembrance for probably all of them of what can occur.
I like to think, we're going to get David and then Janet, that when these plates, and I had no idea because I've never even seen a pictorial representation of it, when all these plates got hammered and put on the sides of the brazen altar, that it was not done to look pretty. And yet I think the brazen altar was absolutely beautiful at the time that it was first constructed. And so now what we have is an altar that causes comment, if seen. And that is, why does it look so unfinished? Why does it look like that? And so it's like, you tell your children, well, I'll tell you when that happens. Thus and so and thus and so. And that is so we don't forget. That's at least my mental picture of what I'm reading here. David?
Well, my question was about that, about the death. In my King James, it says, for a covering of the altar.
Mm-hmm.
Is somewhere else where it explains it more?
I don't know. I had just taken it as I can't put it on the top because that's where all the sacrifices go. The grate is there and so on. So I've always thought that all you've got to deal with is the four sides.
I simply don't know.
Yeah, okay. And, but when I settle that in my mind and go on, it doesn't mean it's right. It just means that I've settled it and I go on. Now let's see, Janet.
I'm struck when Charlene was reading by 25-27, and the Lord rose up and went into Dathan and Abiram, and the elders of Israel followed him. And he spake unto the congregation, saying, depart, I pray you, from the tents of these wicked men, and touch nothing of theirs, lest ye be consumed in all their sins. So they gathered from the tabernacle of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram on every side, and Dathan and Abiram came out and stood in the door of their tents with their wives and their sons and their little children. Then in verse 32, and there was opened up her mouth and swallowed them up, and their houses, and all the men that appertained unto Korah and all their goods. So I think these scriptures are pretty plain that Korah and his whole family was destroyed. I did look at the scripture in Numbers 26, and I like the NIV on this. It says, the 11th verse, the line of Korah, however, did not die out. And I think his sons were destroyed in this manifestation of the Lord's judgment, but the line of Korah continued, and those who served in the tabernacle in that line continued on.
In continuation of that same comment, the lesson for me then is, when I think back, that means that there were family members who did not agree with what Korah was doing. And they took their stand, backed away.
By
backing
away.
Not involved.
Right, by backing away, saying, we're not throwing our lot in. You know, what is going on here?
Just a quick comment. In the second verse, it says when Korah was gathering up those that he was trying to get part of his rebellion, he said he took the 250 were the princes, the famous, and the men of renown. And you can kind of picture that those were the, you know, the leaders, the ones that were natural leaders, probably had a lot of pride. And they look at Moses, you know, Moses wasn't a very eloquent speaker. I mean, Aaron had to speak for him, and, you know, look what he went through when God was telling him what he was going to do. I can't do this, you know. And they probably looked at him like, well, who is he?
Right.
You know, so I think it seems reasonable that those who took part of it were the ones that were very high and mighty and had a lot of pride in their hearts. And
right.
Like Charlie said, that, you know, some of the members of the family
maybe
didn't have that
character. Right. Yeah, that idea of Korah's aligned, not thine out, was new information to me. I just never carried it that far, but it is kind of an instructive principle, because often family ties are pretty strong, but if there's a member of the family that is going off in the wrong direction, don't follow, for heaven's sake. Great.
One of the things in the context of it says two things: sign and memorial. Mm-hmm. So in Hebrew, the word sign there means the visual perception. So there's something visually that they're going to see that keeps it in their minds. Plus, it's being celebrated as a memorial to also keep it in their minds. So you have the people bringing their sacrifices into the court, which you see at the beginning of Leviticus. If it's on the tap on the sides themselves, every time they bring it in, they notice the change. And keep bringing it back to the mind.
Right? Exactly what the point leading at.
I just want to make one comment. You know, it hasn't been said what would the people receive that we found the core together to rebel against Moses and Aaron. But in verse 13, you know, it says, it is a small thing that God has brought us up high of a land that is gorged with milk and honey to kill us in the wilderness, except thy make thyself altogether a threat over us. I think this is the model of intelligence that you're talking about, you know. He stirred, of course, stirred the people up and said, look, right, you're gonna die.
Right.
Moses have brought you here to perish.
Right.
So therefore then, let me the high priest, that is Aaron's position, which he didn't understand that Aaron was appointed by God, not by Moses. And it's obvious that people went along with it. But here again, you know, looking at the brazen altar where they could see these implements that they had beat into, maybe they were on the outside, or they were put on the inside. I'm not so sure about this. Where did they appear?
I vote for the outside, or else it isn't going to be a reminder. Put it on the inside, and it's like, you know, nothing's happened. Nothing's changed.
See, to your point, the president of the NIV said, make an overlay.
Ah,
mm-hmm.
Okay.
So,
completely overlay. Okay, Lynn, and then we want to move on to the last question.
Well, going back to what Lee was talking about, I think the people had forgotten what life was like back in Egypt.
Oh, yes, that nostalgia.
I think they remembered it. They remembered a little bit of the good things, and they forgot.
Nostalgia does that. Oh, how wonderful it was when we were in Egypt. Oh, we had figs and garlic and melons and And nobody seems to remember the fact that we were making bricks without straw. David, and then we are going to go on to the last question.
So this seems to be saying, this is verse 40, that only the sons of Aaron, that is only priests, actually serve at the altar itself, not Levites. So whatever Levites did to help the priesthood, what they didn't do was approach the altar with animal burden.
However, about that, I don't know, David, except that I see the phrase in verse 40, come here to offer incense before the Lord. Now, I'm wondering, is that the offering of incense on the incense altar?
Chapter 18, verse 7, Michael?
18, verse 7, it says what?
But you and your sons with you, speaking to Aaron, you and your sons with you shall attend to your priesthood for everything concerning the altar and inside the veil.
And the altar there is the burnt offering altar?
It must be. It must be the altar. When you think it's the altar, is there? I would think it was the grace altar.
Yeah, I think she's correct.
Okay.
This was not clear to me. I found that it's very helpful.
Right. Okay. So it's nice to have scripture. Right. We are going to, no, we're not. We're going to go to number five. Of course, Korah and the 250 went hand in hand. There's no question about this. This is the kind of a rebellion which if you say, okay, you're excused, don't go and do it again, is not going to work. They, of course, are going to go do it again. So, of course, they have to die. But why is it necessary for God to go in and kill 14,700 husbands? Okay, Joy.
It's so strange to me that after all the miracles that were shown to them, you know, the Red Sea, the whole scenario, that they just turned to other idols and do what they did. And the other, what is it,
14,700.
Well, they, even after this, they went back to serving idols and being in going against Moses and everything, and so they had a play.
Okay, thank you.
And Phineas finally took care of that.
Yes, well, that's of course quite a ways into the future, but yes, indeed so. Have we got a hand of God? We haven't heard from Wade. I always like hands of people who haven't said anything up to this point, because what I would really like is for everybody to say something.
First, a comment and then kind of a question if you get to it. But if I'm reading this right, it could have been more than 14,000. I mean, in fact, if I'm reading it right, I mean, it says the whole congregation of the children of Israel murmured against Moses.
That's for sure.
And he said, he's going to send this plague, and Moses says, Aaron, hurry up and get the censer and run out the door and stand between the plague and them. And he did, and by the time he got there, 14,700 were already dead. If he hadn't stood there,
right. You get the impression
there would have been more dead.
Many more thousand dead.
And so, and my question is there an antidote to the fact that Aaron was standing?
Or are you, David, going to tell us about why is it 14,700?
I have an opinion, but I won't express it.
Okay. let's see. Dad, did you have your hand? Okay, so we'll take that. When I have to operate my memory, it's horrible for all of you.
This is a very practical answer to the question. Paul tells us in the 10th chapter, 1 Corinthians, that all these things happened unto them, for example. And he uses this particular incident in 10th verse. I think he is speaking of this when he says, neither murmur ye, and some of them also murmured and were destroyed of the destroyer.
Right.
So it was for our instruction.
I think it was for our instruction, and what we would really like to do is to just say, and so what did we learn from it? Joanna?
I'm not sure about necessarily what we can learn from it.
No, no, right. Just go ahead and make your comment.
Well, one of the things was the fact that when they had refused to go into the land because of the Sizer Court, the Lord said in Numbers 14:23, they certainly shall not see the land of which I swore to their fathers, nor shall any of those who rejected me see it. and the fact that they were again rejecting the Lord by rejecting Moses and Aaron when they came against them. This was part of the destroying of all those who had come out of Egypt. And in Numbers 26:65, right before they are ready to go into the promised land after the 40 years, it says that none of the ones, 64 and 65, not one of the ones that the priests had numbered when they came out of Egypt were among those that went into the land. And so it was just the beginning of, it's just a long process.
A long process that probably looked like natural forces, you know, people dying a natural death. But when the 14,700 died, this is not natural forces. I'm going to take Ruth because Ruth hasn't said anything, and I follow my rule. And so, if you haven't said anything, boy, you get priority.
I signed up four times about 10 minutes ago.
Yeah, well, when you have it, you're dealing with a leader that's partially blind.
Oh, good. The 250 died in a different way than the family knows. I think it's because it was appropriate to their sin, because in the middle of 39 it says, with which they who were burned had offered incense, so they themselves died by fire instead of the earth.
Okay, good. And Judy?
I wanted to comment on number 1641-42. But on the morrow, all the congregation of the children of Israel murmured against Moses and against Aaron, saying, "Ye have killed the people of the Lord." And they weren't recognizing Aaron and Moses as being chosen of the Lord. They were definitely saying, "These were the people of the Lord."
To me, this is out and out rebellion. This has to be punished. This has to happen, or otherwise, it's not even say anything you want. And it's okay, because for whatever reason. And so, and we see this happening lots of times. This isn't the only place. We see this a lot. When you study the Balaam account, for example, it comes at the end of the wilderness. Same kind of thing. It's like Balaam eventually gets the idea to go to the king of Moab and say, "I can't bring God's curse upon people. You may not believe that. You may think, but I can't. But I can tell you what. There are some things you can do that you can make them bring God's curse upon them. I've studied their history, and I've seen how it can be done. And so if you'll do what I tell you to do, you'll probably get your objective." And in fact, he was right. And so lots more died at that time. We usually think about that or talk about that, but it happened at the end. And so this is what was necessary to stamp out this kind of rebellion, except they never did stand up, because they just did not seem to learn. Now, in the few minutes that we got left, I just would like to see if there are any lessons, because as Janet has made this point, all of this is written for our education. We are expected to be extracting from it something that we can learn from it. Is there anything in what we have read in this historical record that is a lesson for us, and that, in fact, can teach us anything?
I would say be respectful of authority. You know that Paul said of those that serve in the church, they're worthy of double honor if they serve as doctrine and something for work. But I think to be respectful of authority, we live in an age when respect for authority is seriously undermined.
Right.
We shouldn't do that.
Right. It should absolutely not be Charlie.
Be content with the law that the Lord gives us each day.
Good. That's another lesson that we can extract. What else can we extract?
Have confidence that the Lord has a plan for you, even though you may not know, you may not understand the path that you are chosen to walk.
And whatever that plan is far better than any plan your life would to come up with.
Absolutely.
Right. Okay. What else? Joanne. You had your eye on somebody over there, but I didn't see them anymore. Mark, okay, yeah, because I don't see anybody standing.
Just that it can move on the Lord's arrangements, that he knows better than we do.
Yes, right. This idea that somehow we know better than the Lord kind of keeps coming up, kind of. And I don't know why exactly it does, because he seems to have done so well up to this point without our advice. You would have thought that by this time that he had a good track record. Mark?
Something in terms of not being caught up in the things.
leaders here that were inciting the people. I was also thinking about this, the way we're kind of working things. He went after the rebellious group and then the nation of Israel. It's not like the rebrand or error right into the congregation to kind of stop this.
We have to take a more earnest heed to the words we have
we have heard that's the method set, and he goes on to say, we are made partakers of Christ, or of the anointed, and we hold the beginning of our confidence steadfast unto the King. So don't let these things correct.
And last comment.
Well, I think there's a lot of perspective here. I'm just going to read the last two verses of chapter 17. But it didn't. There were three grumblings that went on here with three different results. We had the fire pan, we had the plague, and then we had Aaron's rod that budded. The last two verses in chapter 17 said to Zephaniah, Aaron's staff. But the Israelites said to Moses, lo, we perish. We are lost, all of us lost. Everyone who so much as ventured near the Lord's tabernacle must die. Alas, we are doomed to perish. But thank the Lord through the gift of his Son that we can say just the opposite. By his grace we live. We are going to have life everlasting in the presence of our Father, and all will be good. This is just the opposite. And if they felt doomed, we feel alive.
We do. And thank you for that comment. Thank you all for your participation. We turn it back to our chairman.